Good morning, and welcome to MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Historian Gerhard Weinberg will be one of the main speakers at MTSU's Biennial Holocaust Studies Conference, October 22nd through 24th. The professor emeritus at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill won the Pritzker Award earlier this year for lifetime achievement in military writing. He is the author of numerous books about the defining conflict of the 20th century, including Hitler's Foreign Policy, 1933 to 1939, The Road to World War II, due out in November from Enigma Books. It's a pleasure and an honor to welcome Gerhard Weinberg to MTSU On the Record. Good morning, Dr. Weinberg.
Well, good morning to you.
Your topic for the Holocaust Studies Conference is Roosevelt, Truman, and the Holocaust. So let's start with a question about FDR. When it comes to knowledge of German efforts to annihilate the Jews, to paraphrase Howard Baker, what did Franklin Roosevelt know, and when did he know it?
Well, what we have to keep in mind is that in the 1930s, when he became president in 33 and was reelected, during those years, nobody anticipated what eventually happened. When the systematic killing of Jews begins in the summer of 1941, the United States was still at peace and had, for that reason, diplomats in Europe. In the fall of 1941, the first information begins to trickle out about killing, which at that time is taking place in newly occupied by the Germans portions of the Soviet Union. In the winter of 1941-42, that information becomes sufficiently clear and detailed, ironically, about the same time as the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and the German and Italian declarations of war on the United States draws the United States rather dramatically into World War II. But the information that is coming out of Europe, German-controlled Europe, at that time, we're speaking of the winter of 41-42, is sufficiently dramatic and clear that in January of 1942, the various Allied countries, now being referred to at Roosevelt's suggestion as the United Nations, issue a general condemnation of this mass killing and call for the perpetrators, number one, to stop, and number two, eventually to be tried. This is the St. James Declaration, called that because it is issued from a meeting in the St. James Palace in London.
Is it an unfair argument, then, of FDR to say that the United States, under his presidency, could have taken action earlier than it did, say, right after Kristallnacht, or that they could have allowed the refugees aboard the USS St. Louis into the country?
Well, the point here is that all presidents are required to take an oath of office to enforce the laws of the United States. And the then in effect law, that of 1924, prohibited more than 100,000 people coming into this country a year, and that 100,000 were allocated by a complicated formula. So the fact that a president doesn't like a particular law doesn't somehow mean there is automatically a change in the law. So while during the war, at one point, Roosevelt tried very hard to get around this by admitting people as refugees, this is the so-called Oswego experiment, That immediately led for calls to impeach him. Interesting idea, impeaching the commander-in-chief in the middle of a world war. But that has always seemed to me a bit unfair to blame President Roosevelt for a law that was passed and signed by the only person in history who ever defeated him in an election, namely Calvin Coolidge, until the Congress changed the immigration law, which it began to do after 1945, various displaced persons laws, a lifting of the Chinese exclusion, and some other things. Until that time, President Roosevelt, like any other president, was obliged to enforce the law in effect. What the president could do and did do was to ease the restrictions in applying the existing law that President Hoover had put into effect as one of the few things he tried to do in the Great Depression, that is to say, restrict immigration even further so that the quota wasn't even filled. But Roosevelt did change that so that in the year of the November pogrom to which you referred, the quota at least was filled. The administration of the law is very much up to the president, and in that regard, Roosevelt certainly acted.
Historians are often loath to answer what-if type questions, but are there any indications that the Holocaust might have been either prevented or at least its impact lessened if the United States had become involved in the war earlier than Pearl Harbor?
I'm afraid the answer is the opposite. That is to say, if the United States, let us say, had joined Britain and France in war when the Germans invaded Poland 70 years ago, then it would have been impossible for Jews who still left Germany in small numbers, first across the Soviet Union, the Trans-Siberian Railway, and then across the Pacific. And then after the German occupation of France in the summer of 1940, a small number escaped legally across France, across Spain, to Lisbon in Portugal, and then by ship across the Atlantic. If the United States had been at war with Germany earlier, those probably a few thousand, I'm sorry I cannot give you an exact figure, but those few thousand Jews who were able to leave and escape in the fall of 39, in all of 1940, in most of 1941, would not have been able to escape and come to this country.
I read some rather interesting things about Roosevelt's successor, Harry Truman. There are indications of anti-Semitism. In a 1947 diary passage, Truman wrote that, quote, "the Jews have no sense of proportion," and that the Jews are very, very selfish. At one time he called New York City a kike town, quote unquote. And he's quoted as, during a 1946 cabinet meeting, reportedly saying, "if Jesus Christ couldn't satisfy the Jews while on earth, how the hell am I supposed to?" Yet, this is the man who appointed Robert Jackson to be the U.S. chief of counsel for the Nuremberg trials, and he recognized the State of Israel. So how do you assess Harry Truman's record on these post-World War II matters affecting Jews?
Well, what one has to keep in mind in reading diaries, letters, and minutes of the time is that there were very widespread general prejudices. But what was important, I would argue, is not what people privately said and thought, but what they actually did. And that was particularly important, obviously, for individuals holding high office. the other side of that is that Truman had personal friends who were Jewish and associates who were Jewish. And on the issues of what he did, there is no question, I don't see how there can be any question, that he played an important role in helping the surviving Jews in the displaced persons camps in American occupation zone in Germany. And that was a very active and very important issue in the years 1945, 46, 47, 48, 49, that is to say the critical early years of the Truman presidency. And the president's hand, shall we say, is very clear in this, and the American military, who were effectively in charge, had no doubt in their minds as to what the president wanted. Furthermore, against strong resistance from within the State Department, the president, President Truman, first pushed for substantial additional Jewish survivor immigration into Palestine while it was still a British mandate, then pushed for a Jewish state created, as you know, probably by the United Nations Organization resolution, in which, as I said, against the majority of his advisors in the State Department, Truman pushed for this. And as you just mentioned, Truman immediately recognized in 1948 the independence of the State of Israel, and that set, if you will, a kind of pattern for at least a substantial number of other countries to do the same. And that, it seems to me, what was important, what he wrote and said privately, is another matter.
As you know, Leni Riefenstahl, the documentarian propagandist, used her remarkable skills in order to promote the purposes of the Third Reich, but ironically, after the war was over and Allied troops moved into the concentration camps, Eisenhower ordered the armed forces personnel to film what they saw there. And this use of film became part of newsreels that were shown in theaters across the country. Do you think that, in spite of all the print documentation of the Nazi horrors, that we would still have a difficult time, or people of the era would have had a difficult time really comprehending its depth without those moving images of the human wreckage that the Third Reich perpetrated?
Yes, I think that the at a time when there's no television, people receive their visual impacts of the war, of the horrors, and so on, either by individual pictures in magazines like Life, where some began to appear in the winter, pictures began to appear in the winter of 1944-45, or in newsreels. In those days, most people went to movies more frequently than they do today, and between, before, or after, whatever feature films people had gone to see, they would see newsreels. And those newsreels were the main source of image impact of all parts of World War II for people at home. And certainly the newsreel images of the horrors that were exposed as first Russian troops in Eastern Europe and Eastern Germany, and then British and American and Canadian troops in the West moved in, and then the movie pictures taken there in Dachau, in Mauthausen, in Bergen-Belsen, are cut into the newsreels that people would see, not when they went to see newsreels, but when they went to see whatever the feature film was that they paid admission to see. But this gets thrown in. And, of course, the newspapers also would run a few pictures in addition to accounts and stories. And the comments of American soldiers as they came to these places and talked to American reporters who were out there. Certainly this gave ordinary people back here at home a shock and a substantiation of what they had been reading about in the newspapers, but could not really grasp as anything of this kind is very difficult for people to develop any appreciation and understanding of without some of the pictures and newsreels that they saw, especially in the spring and summer of 1945.
Let me ask you some questions now that use contemporary events as sort of jumping-off points. This year, as you know, marks the 70th anniversary of Nazi Germany's invasion of Poland. This is an event which brought the bitterness between Poland and Russia bubbling to the surface as some people in the Polish press sought an apology from Germans and Russians for the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. Would such apologies do anything for better relations among nations today?
Well, I think this has to be seen as a matter of public perception of the other. That is to say, everybody knows today that nobody who was killed in Poland when the Germans invaded on the 1st of September, or when the Soviets invaded on the 16th, 17th of September, nobody who was killed then is ever going to be brought back to life. And people don't expect that. What is important to them is a sense of, have these other people, their children, their grandchildren, the current generation, changed? Do they realize what awful things were done in the name of their country and by people from their country? And if there is a sense, yes, they do realize what happened, and they're very sorry about it, that's one way in which there can be eventually reconciliation. If, on the other hand, there is a continuing unwillingness to face up to this, to recognize what awful things people did in the past, then you don't see reconciliation. And I think there is a very clear-cut difference between what's been happening among the publics in Europe and the publics in East Asia, because of the unwillingness of the Japanese leadership and much of its society to face up to not what they're doing, but what was done there in the past. And the result of this is that while there is, in much of Europe, I would argue, a kind of sense of reconciliation with Germans, with German people, in East Asia, that reconciliation has not taken place. And I recall when I once had occasion in 1997 to comment on this issue at a series of lectures I was asked to give in Tokyo, I had some very unpleasant looks from some people in the audience, but two of the people teaching at the National Institute for Defense Studies came up to me afterwards and said to me that they knew what I was talking about, because when they go as tourists to Seoul, the capital of Korea, or Manila, the capital of the Philippines, they don't dare speak to each other in Japanese for fear of being physically attacked by people who hear that hated language. Now, obviously, none of the people either who would beat up on them or the ones who are going have anything to do with anything that happened 60 years ago, 70 years ago. But the question is, what are the attitudes of people? And those attitudes are not going to change in Eastern Europe until and unless there is a perception of willingness on the part of leadership and the public in Russia to face up to some of the terrible things that they did to others. Nobody can undo them, and nobody can expect anybody to come back to life. But the whole current and future relationship of peoples to each other are very much affected, I would suggest, by a willingness or unwillingness to recognize that in the past something was done that was very, very bad.
Speaking of seeing people as the other, Americans are certainly not immune. As you know, an unrepentant white supremacist and anti-Semite is charged with the murder of a guard at the U.S. Holocaust Museum, which took place in June of this year. Do you think that this tragic incident will serve to ignite the collective conscience and remind us in this country that hate groups are still very much alive?
Unfortunately, people find it sometimes easier to hate than to appreciate others. And the danger with hate always is that it can spill from bad thoughts to evil deeds. And in the case of this individual who's charged with this murder, there is a long record of hate, of bad thoughts. And in this particular instance, the evidence suggests that this led the individual to a horrendous deed. The possibility of this is always present. Nobody is born with an inoculation against hate. The potential and the possibility is unfortunately always there. And individuals, as they mature and grow up, have to decide in themselves whether they want to disagree with others, whether they want to hold unpleasant views of others, or whether they want to cross over a rather fine, not easily defined line between not liking someone or not agreeing with someone or not approving of someone, but moving over into hating individuals or groups or people because they belong to some group that one hates. That danger is always there. And while we're currently searching and hoping to find some kind of a shot to get put into the arm against this new form of flu that we're all worried about, nobody, in my opinion, will ever find one that will keep human beings from hating. If that's what they decide to do, that choice, that terrible choice is always there. And unfortunately, inherent in that choice, the choice to hate, is always the possibility, not the certainty, but the possibility of moving from hate to violent action, including murder.
Finally, Dr. Weinberg, there have been signs equating President Obama with Adolf Hitler and images of him with a Hitler mustache at town hall meetings and on the internet in recent months. What does the use of Hitler's image, Nazi symbols, and the casual use of the word Nazi in describing contemporary people and situations do to our overall perspective on what real Nazis did?
Well, it does two things. It leaves the original one as horrendous as it was, and for political purposes, tries to transfer them to current individuals who then supposedly have those same qualities. And that certainly opens up the legitimization of the negative attitudes and hatreds and need for defense that at one time were a major part of the American war effort in World War II. That is to say, this is something so dangerous to our society that we have to militarily, we have to defend ourselves against it. And that makes it easier then for people today to cross over, as I mentioned before, the line from disagreeing with somebody or having somewhat differing views on subject A, B, or C, into a kind of hatred that very quickly then leads to the next step, which is to violence.
Renowned historian Gerhard Weinberg, who will be one of the speakers at MTSU's Biennial Holocaust Studies Conference here on the campus, October 22nd through the 24th. This is MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com. And we're also available on iTunes.